Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and discuss the collapse of an attempt by Americans-elect to open up this year's presidential race with an online selection of candidates. Joining us is the former mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, a presidential candidate on the Justice Party ticket who is fighting for ballot access against the Republican stranglehold on America's democracy that makes a mockery of our ideology of free market choice. Then we'll look into a new study released today by Global Zero, an international nonpartisan group of 300 world leaders dedicated to eliminating nuclear weapons. Bruce Blair, who directed the study, joins us to discuss the findings of a panel led by General Cartwright, the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the former commander of U.S. nuclear forces, who is now calling for deep cuts in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Then, as evidence of recklessness on Wall Street mounts, we'll examine efforts on the part of the Republicans on the agriculture committees, who have oversight over derivatives trading, to water down regulations even further. Bartlett Naylor, the former chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, joins us to discuss how Wall Street lobbyists write the legislation on these complex and esoteric financial instruments to allow unregulated overseas activities that often end up with the taxpayer holding the bag. Joining us now is Rocky Anderson, who was the mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. During his time in office, he became known as a progressive voice in Utah politics, and he became internationally renowned for his Salt Lake City Green Program, which drastically reduced the carbon footprint of the city's municipal operations. He serves as president of the Utah-based nonprofit organization High Road for Human Rights. And Mayor Rocky Anderson is running for president on the newly formed Justice Party ticket. He is running a citizen finance campaign that rejects special interest and corporate funding. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rocky Anderson.
Thanks very much.
So I understand you've had some trouble getting on ballots here for your presidential run, and Americans-elect have already gotten on 29 ballots, including California. This is an attempt to elect a president via the internet. But now we learn from a front-page story in today's Los Angeles Times that Americans-elect's whole operation is faltering. You and Governor Buddy Romo were leading candidates. Where does that leave you? Can you use their ballot access since you've had so much trouble getting on ballots?
No, we can't use theirs. They were pursuing a course that I think was certainly very unique and creative, and it could have opened up our democracy in quite extraordinary ways, but they set the criteria so high and in a discriminatory fashion, frankly, so that none of the people who were declared candidates with Americans Elect met those initial criteria to get to the first round of voting. Buddy Romer needed to get 1,000 supporters in each of 10 states, yet because I had not been mayor of one of the 100 most populous cities and hadn't served as a governor or senator or such, I actually was mayor of Salt Lake City for 8 years, and Salt Lake City is the 125th most populous state. So since I fell into a different category, they required that I have 5,000 supporters in each of 10 different states, which was basically saying there's no way that people in that category, we second-class candidates, as it were, had any prayer, really, of making it into the first round of balloting. But now neither is Buddy Romer or anybody else. So I don't know what they're going to do. I've received a lot of emails saying that there's a consideration of changing the rules at this late date. I just think that they made a lot of mistakes, didn't put in place new rules when they should have realized that nobody was going to be making that initial threshold. My campaign has been really focusing primarily on getting our own ballot access. And Ian, I can tell you, after getting into this and working it the way that we have, and it's the first time I've ever really focused on this, I can say to the American people, we have an incredibly anti-democratic system. Not just undemocratic, it's anti-democratic, where the Republican and Democratic parties have in so many different states made it virtually impossible for those who have a different point of view, who want to offer a different voice, different solutions, where they have almost no chance at all of getting on the ballot in those states. I mean, Americans Elect has spent $15 million on ballot access so far and is nowhere close to getting on all of the states' ballots. So we're still struggling. We're still at it. I just received the Progressive Party nomination in Oregon. I'm going to be on the ballot in Oregon. We're on the ballot in Utah and Mississippi. I have been seeking the nomination of the Peace and Freedom Party in California because they do have a ballot slot because they've been on in the past. We'll be working in probably 30 different states with great volunteers, with signature gathering campaigns. But in many of the states, we've just given up. Their threshold is way too high. It would cost virtually millions of dollars to get on the ballots in several of these different states.
Again, I'm speaking with former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who is running for president on the newly formed Justice Party ticket. He's running a citizen finance campaign that rejects special interest and corporate funding. And we're talking about the apparent collapse of Americans Elect, which is a new idea of nominating a president via the internet. And as you mentioned, Rocky, they've spent about $15 million on ballot access. The last time anybody was able to do that, I guess, similarly, was Ross Perot. So clearly, when you say the system's rigged, it sounds like you have to be a billionaire to run for president in the United States. And Peter Ackerman, who's the funder behind Americans Elect, of course, was a partner with Drexel Burnham Lambert here. The infamous Michael Milken was able, obviously, to make considerable amounts of money and avoid jail, for that matter. In terms of what they've done so far, if you're trying to get on other ballots, like in California, on the Peace and Freedom ballot, could Americans Elect open their already existing 29 state ballots up to people like you? I mean, why go to all this work and have it amount to nothing?
Well, I think what they're contemplating is coming up with some way of allowing the nomination of someone so that they can take advantage of their ballot access. But to do that, they would have to change their rules now at the end of the game in very dramatic ways. I asked a representative of Americans Elect weeks ago. I think it was, in fact, probably before the panel discussion, which I participated with you and Buddy Romer and the representatives of representative of Americans Elect. And I was told, no, that they were likely just to keep the rules as they were and see how it all panned out. But I think it's really unfortunate that we have to go to these lengths to get people on ballots, to provide a choice for American voters. I mean, how shameful is it that our choices are limited basically to the Republican and Democratic parties, both of whom who have brought us to this disastrous point in our nation's history, both of whom have been warmongering parties who have caved to the military-industrial complex, who have been pursuing illegal wars of aggression, who have engaged in the horrendous human rights abuses, who have handed Wall Street bankers just about everything they could possibly want, and now in the face of massive fraud on Wall Street, turn a blind eye to it and say, as they said about war crimes and about illegal surveillance of American citizens' communications, that let's just look forward and not backwards, that we're not going to hold them criminally accountable. This is what we get with Republican and Democratic parties, and the American people are not hearing the truth. They're not hearing alternative, serious voices about what we need to do to take things in a very different direction. Now, the Washington Post just wrote a very condescending piece. It was Dana Milbank, in typical mainstream media fashion, pandering to the establishment, saying, oh, they didn't get any of these kinds of candidates. Well, you know, the only candidates that seem to be okay to the mainstream media are those who have been like lapdogs to Wall Street, who have lined up blindly in support of wars of aggression, the kind of disaster that happened in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. They've got it nailed. It's just amazing that now, not only in terms of ballot access, but mainstream media treatment, and of course then, look at what's happened to the presidential debates with both the Republican Democratic parties forming together the Presidential Debate Commission, and that is a solely owned entity of the Republican Democratic parties. They're the ones that created it, sure. Hijacked away from the League of Women Voters, the presidential debates, and they don't allow anybody else on the stage with them. And then they dictate when they're going to be held, what the format's going to be, who the moderators are going to be. It's been an unbelievable debasement of our democracy at every stage. And if people wonder why we're in a new gilded age with the greatest disparity of income and wealth since the 1920s, if they're wondering why we've driven up the national debt the way we have, and yet military spending cuts are off the table, why we keep doing the bidding of the large, wealthy corporations to the detriment of the American public, we can see it's all come about because of this degradation of our democracy and the fact that the American people, who are getting shafted day in and day out by both those who reside in the White House and who serve in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, it's because we're denied these kinds of choices and the American people aren't standing up and demanding a return of their democracy in the face of this absolute plutocracy, rule of the wealthy, that we now have in the United States.
Well, Mayor Rocky Anderson, again, running for President of the United States on the newly formed Justice Party ticket. He's running a citizen finance campaign that rejects special interest and corporate funding. You mentioned the forum that I hosted you and Buddy Romer and the representative of Americans-elect recently at the UCLA Hammer Forum. And I must say that both you and Buddy Romer were really powerful speakers. And I can see why they don't want you guys on the debate stage, because you would have wiped the floor with these other guys that they put up.
Well, thank you. And I think it's true. I would relish the opportunity to be on the stage before the people in this nation with Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. As our republic is being undermined, as the rule of law is being ignored, as our constitutional rights are being decimated, as the very, very wealthy still are raking it in and everybody else is having such a difficult time, we, the American people, deserve to hear these alternative voices. We deserve to be told the truth finally, and for there to be an enriched democracy where we can make these choices rather than being stuck with this duopoly of the Republican and Democratic parties, both of whom are feeding from the same trough of special interest money.
What is depressing about the idea that Americans elect are kind of collapsing after all that money was spent, they've gone on 29 state ballots, and the idea that they set rules that kind of clogged up the system. And my understanding is that in the internet age, and after all, the whole idea is to elect a president over the, or nominate a president over the internet, they set up a system that wasn't particularly internet friendly. And it was very hard to log on and cast your nomination. And the rules, as you mentioned, were kind of onerous and arbitrary. It's a tragedy that they could have screwed it up so badly. One, in cumbersome rules, and two, for an internet operation, not to have got some smart tech people to set up a system that was both secure and user-friendly. I mean, haven't they heard of Silicon Valley?
I'm not all that technically savvy, but I can tell you it took me far too long to be able to cast my vote of support on the system. And others have told me that they tried repeatedly and even made phone calls to Americans Elect and were not able to get on. So there were people who were disenfranchised because of some aspect of the technology, apparently. And it all did take too long. I think they expected that people were going to go far out of their way to be able to participate. And at the same time, and it was noted by everybody during that panel discussion we had, the funding for this operation is pretty suspect. It looks like it mostly came from hedge fund people. And there was very little, if any, transparency about the sources of the funding. And so on the one hand, they want to say, we're trying to give the American people a choice and open up our democracy. And on the other hand, it looks like it was all corporate or hedge fund money primarily, and they weren't disclosing those sources. So I don't think you can have it both ways. And actually, I took a lot of heat from a lot of people. Still am taking heat from people for declaring my candidacy on Americans Elect. But I must say, I declared my candidacy primarily to get the word out about our campaign, because we are not letting up in terms of our ballot access efforts and building up the Justice Party and taking every opportunity we can to get on the ballots, regardless of what happens with Americans Elect.
And of course, Rocky, you're doing it the grassroots way. It means you don't have the kind of money that Ross Perot had to put himself on the ballot, then Peter Ackerman and his billionaire buddies have had with Americans Elect, which, you know, they've managed to blow in spite of all the money.
Well, that's exactly right. But I can tell you it's very, very difficult to do this with simply volunteers. You need people who are accountable. I think there are a lot of candidates, and I know Americans Elect paid people to go out and get signatures. I would like to think that people around this country are concerned enough about the state of our nation that they would get out in droves and help get signatures and help do whatever's possible to get alternatives on the ballot. You know, we went over to Eastern Europe, the United States, in 1990. And I think it led to the Helsinki Accords. And we spelled out what it took for there to be a real democracy. Here we're lecturing these East European countries. And one of the things, and it's in writing, that's so absolutely necessary, and I quote, respect the right of individuals and groups to establish in full freedom their own political parties or other political organizations, and provide such political parties and organizations with the necessary legal guarantees to enable them to compete with each other on a basis of equal treatment before the law and by the authorities. Now, that sounds like democracy to me.
Right.
And yet we betray that interest throughout this country in making it so virtually impossible for everybody except the very wealthy to be able to get on the ballot. I mean, why do we even need to jump through these hoops like these folks did with Americans Elect? $25 million?
So I have to leave it now, Rocky Anderson, but it is truly, I think, a national disgrace, and I think people should recognize how broken their democracy is. And of course, we pride ourselves as a free market country based upon choice and marketplace choices and all of that stuff that you keep hearing largely from these Republican candidates. And yet we don't have choices when it comes to the most fundamental thing of all, which is who's on the ballot and, you know, a broad menu to select from.
Well, that's right. And I just think the message has got to be that it's up to we the people. You know, we have to show the kind of will and tenacity that it requires for us to take our government back. And I know that sounds like a slogan, but it's the absolute truth. The moneyed interests have controlled it. They've got the two parties in their hip pockets. We, the American people, have got to insist and organize in every way possible for change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Rocky Anderson.
Thank you, Ian. It's a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Rocky Anderson, who's the mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. And during his time in office, he became known as a progressive voice in Utah politics and internationally renowned for his Salt Lake City Green program, which drastically reduced the carbon footprint of the city's municipal operations. He serves as president of the Utah-based nonprofit organization High Road for Human Rights. And Mayor Rocky Anderson is running for president on the newly formed Justice Party ticket. And he's running a citizen finance campaign that rejects special interest and corporate funding. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about a new report that urges the United States to drastically reduce its nuclear stockpile.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you've never gone before. So let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot, and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one. There'll be no one left to blame.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bruce Blair, who's the president of the World Security Institute, a nonprofit organization he founded in 2000 to promote independent research and journalism on global affairs. He's executive producer of Countdown to Zero, a documentary film on nuclear weapons, which was released in 2010. He also created and was the executive producer of the PBS Weekly television series Superpower Global Affairs Television for Global Superpower Global Affairs Television. He was also the executive producer on two television documentaries, CNN Presents Deadlock, Russia's Forgotten War, and PBS's Frontlines, Missile Wars in 2002. Dr. Blair is the co-founder and coordinator of Global Zero, an international nonpartisan group of 300 world leaders dedicated to achieving the elimination of nuclear weapons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Blair.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And your group, Global Zero, have just released a report on that basically calls for drastic reductions, large cuts in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The title of the report is?
It's the Global Zero U.S. Nuclear Policy Commission Report. It's a report of a group of Global Zero luminaries led by General James Cartwright, who recently retired as vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and previously served as the head of U.S. nuclear forces based in Omaha, Nebraska.
So you have a situation where senior American military officers are taking the position that less nuclear warheads in the American arsenal improves America's security?
Well, that's absolutely right. And not only some generals on this commission, but President Reagan's chief nuclear arms negotiator and Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican from Nebraska, and former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Thomas Pickering. So it's a very professional, esteemed group of moderate and even conservative figures who put forth a case that I think everyone pretty much can understand, that the Cold War is long over and that the bloated arsenals of the United States and Russia need to be further reduced rather sharply, and that we need to develop a strategy for the 21st century to address the real threats that the country faces, not to fight the old Cold War with a large nuclear arsenal. So it's really kind of a common sense report. It's just that it's so hard in Washington, D.C., and in Moscow, for that matter, for these security establishments to really take the leap into common sense and to take advantage of the end of the Cold War and to divert resources into the areas of that actually pose threats to our countries.
So, again, I speak with Bruce Blair, who's the president of the World Security Institute, a nonprofit organization he founded in 2000 to promote independent research and journalism on global affairs. He's also the co-founder and coordinator of Global Zero, an international nonpartisan group of 300 world leaders dedicated to achieving the elimination of nuclear weapons. And Global Zero have just come out with a report today, headed by the former commander of U.S. Nuclear forces, who's calling for large cuts in the nuclear war arsenal of the United States, down to 900 warheads. Is that what?
That's right, Ian. An 80% reduction from the current levels. We call on Russia to take similar cuts to their arsenal. And really, the logic here, again, is to accelerate the process of dismantling the really, truly bloated arsenals of the Cold War, and to get both sides down to a level below 1,000 total weapons of all categories that would engage the other nuclear weapons countries, would bring us down to a level that would put us more or less into the same league with some other countries, and would provide a basis, a logic, a rationale for those other countries to join into the first in history multilateral negotiations for the reduction of nuclear weapons. Because, you know, the bilateral U.S.-Russia relationship really isn't the most important one today, in a way. The real big nuclear dangers that reside in the world today are found in places like South Asia, in Pakistan, which has a fast-growing nuclear arsenal.
My understanding is that the Pakistani arsenal has surpassed the arsenal of France and is close to the arsenal of Britain, and it is the fastest-growing arsenal in the world. In the notion of that the big guys, the Russians and the Americans, are not in a position to preach to others to give up their nuclear weapons when they have such extraordinary numbers, I take it that's at the heart of what you're proposing and what your study proposes. But how do you deal with the people like the Pakistanis? What kind of moral suasion is there? Assuming that we were able to cut our arsenals down, what's driving them, for example?
Well, what's driving them is a perceived threat from India, and the need in their view, and this is a country that's ruled by the military and thinks like military establishments think, that they need nuclear weapons to defend the country against an invasion by India if a conflict over Kashmir or some other conflict drove the two sides to the brink or over the brink of conventional war. And India has a vastly superior conventional forces. And so it's basically thinking that the United States and NATO indulged in during the 1950s and 60s. You need nuclear weapons, in their view, to fend off a vastly superior conventional force. So there are definitely arguments to be made with each and every country with nuclear weapons, and there are 9 of them now. Every country has a different kind of calculus of the security of their country and the role of nuclear weapons in the defense of their country. And so you have to take these countries on a case-by-case basis. But if the United States and Russia really take the lead in this arena, I think that we can bring other countries into the process, particularly the United Kingdom and France and China. And as these other countries join a process, it becomes very, very hard for the others to stay on the sidelines.
Well, of course, Bruce Blair, the when you mentioned that NATO doctrine, which was a first strike doctrine during the Cold War, which was predicated on the assumption that the Warsaw Pact had superior numbers in conventional arms, and of course, in retrospect, you know, the notion that the Poles and the Hungarians and all of those people would have died for the Russians, there's a little suspect in, you know, but there's obviously no way that you can persuade the Pakistanis, for example, that India may be less of a threat than the jihadis within their own country.
Well, it's a hard thing to sell. That's true, but the fact of the matter is that the biggest threat to Pakistan is internal, and it's chaos. It's the jihadist threat to the government. And if you travel around Pakistan, there are checkpoints everywhere, and policemen are checking under cars for bombs, and those are not Indian bombs that they're checking for. But somehow the Pakistani military cannot let go of its obsession with the Indian threat. But things change. I mean, views of security are radically changing. That's why Global Zero has so much traction around the world. In countries like India, where the nuclear program was very popular 10 or 15 years ago, you now find very senior Indian security experts with enormous experience, including the highest-ranking military officers, who believe that it's in India's best interest now to live in a world without nuclear weapons because of the emergence of the threat of nuclear terrorism. That Mumbai would possibly go up in radioactive smoke the next time instead of attacked with small arms. And so that's a view that is also more and more prevalent in the United States, that the biggest threat to this country, nuclear threat, probably lies in the arena of nuclear terrorism rather than a deliberate attack by a country like Russia or China. So views are changing, and I think we have gained a lot of support around the world for the agenda of Global Zero. And the first step is to start reducing or make further reductions in U.S. and Russian forces, but it's also to bring all the countries with nuclear weapons into the dialogue.
Again, I'm speaking with Bruce Blair, who is the president of the World Security Institute, a nonprofit organization he founded in 2000 to promote independent research and journalism on global affairs. He is the co-founder and co-director of Global Zero, an international nonpartisan group of 300 world leaders dedicated to achieving the elimination of nuclear weapons. And he directed the study released today, headed up by former commander of the U.S. nuclear forces, that calls for a large cut in America's nuclear arsenal. Now, will you be able to sell this on the basis of saving money from the Pentagon? I mean, you know, they've had they made that deal to sequester money if they couldn't come up with a budget agreement, and now the Republicans in the House are reneging on the deal on these automatic cuts and saying, well, we got to balance, you know, we can take money out of food stamps, etc. Surely this is a time to find some low-hanging fruit, isn't it, in terms of the defense budget?
And you're absolutely right. And it's not an argument that is hard to sell to the Pentagon, certainly if there's sequestration and severe cuts in defense spending. The hard choices are going to have to be made within the Pentagon. And even if the budget isn't squeezed quite that severely, there's still hard choices ahead. You simply cannot rebuild all of the nuclear forces that we currently deploy at sea and on land and in the air without virtually bankrupting the defense budget. For example, just to rebuild and replace Trident submarines that carry our long-range nuclear missiles at sea would consume about 75% of the Navy's entire shipbuilding budget for many years. The Navy, the military, uniformed military in the Navy, prefers to spend that money on weapons that they can use, not on weapons that they know can't be used. Nuclear weapons, in the eyes of the military, simply are not usable weapons. They're weapons for deterrence, and the number needed for deterrence is much smaller than we currently deploy. So there are really actually quite a lot of allies in the Pentagon for making the kind of choices that are laid out in this report.
Well, my understanding that is that a lot of the submarines that used to have nuclear weapons aboard them have been converted to intelligence platforms. I mean, you know, since the end of the Cold War, we've still got a pretty robust fleet, don't we, of what they call boomers?
Yeah, those are submarines that carry missiles that have long range and are armed with nuclear weapons, and those are not used for surveillance platforms. It's a different category of submarine that's used for intelligence. But the boomers, which are these strategic offensive submarines, are being converted. There used to be 18 of these Trident boomers. There are now 14 going down. Four of them have been converted to carry conventional cruise missiles. So a boomer that used to carry nuclear weapons now carries 150 Tomahawk cruise missiles that are armed with conventional weapons. So there's, you know, a transformation underway, converting nuclear to conventional. There's another big transformation underway, converting from offense to defense. And you know, the budget for these, for modernizing or replacing these weapons, the cost of that is really extremely high, and no one really believes that that the country can afford to replace all of these weapons, the submarines, the bombers, and the land-based rockets. There are going to have to be some real difficult choices made, and our report calls for entirely eliminating the land-based leg, the rockets, the missiles that are based in Montana, in North Dakota, in Wyoming, that are aimed at primarily at Russia.
So, Bruce Blair, the U.S. military are pushing this. They understand the need to do this, that it both saves money and it adds to our security. It may be a hard sell to conservatives and in the Senate and the House, particularly, I think, if there's not some reciprocity on the Russian side. What's the likelihood of reciprocity on the Russian side? Because you've got Putin, who is now being pretty smoked out as a kind of a gangster, and he's canceled his trip to Camp David, and he's not the most savory guy in the world. But what's the feeling within the Russian military?
Well, the Russian military wants to hold on to a large arsenal of so-called tactical weapons, the smaller weapons that they think they might have to use to defend their country from threats along their southern border, such as China. But there are a lot of weapons in the Russian inventory that are clearly aging, that have lost or are losing all of their military utility, even in the eyes of the Russian military. And the Russians understand also that these long-range rockets, whose main role is to fight a large-scale nuclear war with the United States, that's an obsolete, increasingly obsolete mission, that this idea of mutual assured destruction is no longer kind of the cornerstone of the relationship between our two countries, and that there's a lot of latitude to cut. Now, I think with leadership from the Obama administration, that the Russians will engage, and they will come around to agree to cut. Now, I think going down as low as we're proposing would be a very, very difficult negotiation. And we certainly are not advocating unilateral nuclear disarmament. We are calling on the Russians to come down to the same deep level of cuts.
Well,
but yeah, it's a tough sell there, and Russia has weakness in its conventional weapons, and its demographics are poor. They cannot field a large standing army any longer the way they once could. And so they psychologically feel that they depend more on nuclear weapons than they used to.
So, but the still U.S. plans could accommodate the notion that the Russians need their nuclear deterrent more than we do.
Well, I think that we could appreciate that they don't have nearly as much confidence in their conventional forces, and I think that we have ample latitude to start cutting our nuclear forces unilaterally, and that we give Russia the opportunity to begin a cutting process at perhaps a somewhat slower pace. But there's plenty of room for maneuver here, in my opinion. Also, you know, it's expensive for the Russians as well, and they have actually a tough economy right now. And they could, and they're facing the same sort of choices to upgrade and modernize their nuclear weapons and replace them that we're facing. And so they have a lot of money to be saved by coming down with us.
Well, Bruce Blair, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Blair, who's the president of the World Security Institute, a nonprofit organization that he founded in 2000 to promote independent research and journalism on global affairs. He is the co-founder and co-director of the Global Zero, an international nonpartisan group of 300 world leaders dedicated to achieving the elimination of nuclear weapons. And he directed the study just released today, headed by a former commander of U.S. nuclear forces, calling for large cuts in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about, in spite of this latest scandal on Wall Street, there are some people in Congress who want to deregulate derivatives even further.
Starched white sheds, you will find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean sheds to play around with.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
And it's pretty extraordinary to see that in the wake of J.P. Morgan's $2 to $3 billion loss, the House Committee on Agriculture yesterday was about to vote on two bills that would roll back Wall Street reform on speculative derivative bets. I take it mostly to do with commodities. What happened? Finally, they got shamed into canceling it?
Yes, I think that's pretty clear. The chairman of the committee, Frank Lucas, put out a statement saying that J.P. Morgan has nothing to do with it in canceling this vote. At the same time, he said that Congress needs to look into make sure there are no, in his words, unintended consequences. And so I think what's clear is that very much J.P. Morgan led to at least some small and I hope not fleeting humility by these lawmakers to emasculate Dodd-Frank.
And in terms of these being House committees on agriculture, now I take it that these relate to derivatives in commodity trading.
Yes, we shouldn't be confused by nomenclature here. it's a quirk of jurisdiction between committees that the House Agriculture Committee has oversight of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And it's safe to say that until the 1970s or 1980s, that did have to do with wheat futures and cattle futures. But Wall Street has decided to go through that particular area of trading to create a whole blizzard of financial-related derivatives. Derivative is a multisyllabic word that means bet. And that's where a lot of the shenanigans that took place that led to the financial crash of 2008 took place. And so it is the Agriculture Committee. You know, members of Congress who are really concerned about farming are nevertheless the stewards of shaping policy about these complex derivatives, half of which are traded in London.
So if Agriculture Committee has oversight over the CFTC, and the CFTC now is completely being emasculated by pressure from Wall Street. The president even had to get Eric Holder on the White House lawn the other day to talk about the need to maybe put somebody in jail for running up the price of gasoline up to 40%. The rest of the country is getting a little bit of relief. California is not in terms of gas prices. But this is all of, in other words, derivatives trading in agriculture commodities and gaming the price of gasoline. It's all now under the jurisdiction of this House Agriculture Committee that, in the face of all that's been happening, want to deregulate the rules further?
Yes. Well, it's Wall Street that wants to deregulate the rules, and then they make campaign contributions to the members of the House and the House Agriculture Committee, and then they follow the money and are putting forward these bills. Three swap deregulation bills have already cleared the entire House, and there's about five in the pipeline. Some have already cleared the Agriculture Committee and await full floor action. The two others that were going to be voted on this Thursday. One of them, Alice in Wonderland style, was called the Swap Bailout Prevention Act, but it actually explicitly allows for a bailout of swaps. Again, swaps is the same word as derivatives. These are these commodity, in this case, synthetic financial swaps. The other bill would have said if you do the swap overseas, you are essentially liberated from U.S. oversight. So, first of all, go to London, fail, and then we will bail you out.
Well, there's a pattern of that, isn't there? Isn't that what happened with AIG?
And that's the American way, yeah.
And then you had this recent J.P. Morgan Chase disaster happened in London. The so-called London Whale, this Frenchman who made these bad bets. I take it though these House members that are deregulating. Do they know what they're doing? I mean, most people don't even know what a credit default swap is or a derivative is.
No, they don't. They don't know what they're doing. I'm one of the few people that call around to the members of Congress. I do mostly or almost all the time deal with their staff, and most of the staff really are not sure precisely of the language of their own bills, which are written not by them, but are written by law firms. Sometimes the letterhead of the law firm is still on the memo that is being passed around. And no, it's very cleverly written. Just one example, the bill that exempts or liberates from any U.S. oversight swaps that are taking place in London is maybe 500 words long that has a lot of language about it. It's only for hedging or it's only for this or only for that. Well, there's five words that do all the damage, and that says all swaps overseas are essentially liberated from U.S. oversight. So the other language is almost there to confuse you.
But I find this extraordinary that the U.S. Taxpayer is being put on the hook by conservative lawmakers who are out there screaming about the deficit. I mean, isn't one of the biggest causes of the deficit rescuing and bailing out Wall Street?
Yes, it's not only the cash dollars that taxpayers put into J.P. Morgan, $25 billion, or AIG, $150 billion, but it's also the lost tax revenue. The 8.1% unemployed are not paying taxes. The stimulus money is part of the financial crisis. Yes, I believe that if Americans paid attention to what is happening in Congress, they would be very upset. But as you had mentioned before, these bills are complex. They are misunderstood even by professional staff in Congress. And it is within this complexity that the muggers of Wall Street are hiding.
Again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as a chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. And we're talking about how the House Committee on Agriculture yesterday canceled a scheduled vote for Thursday on two bills that would roll back Wall Street reforms on speculative derivatives, even though they are saying it has nothing to do with the J.P. Morgan $2 to $3 billion loss. That's I don't know what to say. I mean, that's pretty incredible. What's the role of Senator Corker on the other side, on the Senate Banking Committee? He's already called for hearings into the J.P. Morgan fiasco. He's one of the richest guys in the House and Senate, isn't he?
I think he does have a lot of competition. You know, there's a Rockefeller, and,
sure,
and there are others that have a few dollars in their own bank account. Senator Corker is an interesting person because when you hear him speak, when he's at Senate Banking Committee hearings, he'll often say what I would call the right things that we're concerned. He said that we need to get rid of proprietary trading. But when it comes to votes, he often doesn't, if you will, vote what I would call the right way. We certainly welcome his call for hearings. There'll actually be a hearing next Tuesday already scheduled with the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission as well as the Securities and Exchange Commission. And inevitably, the J.P. Morgan issue will be raised, if not actually dominate that hearing. We're working with staff right now about questions that they may wish to consider.
But let's focus in a moment, Bartlett Naylor, on the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. I've spoken a few times with Michael Greenberger, who was formerly the head of the Division of Trading and Markets, and he's been one of the people that's been blowing the whistle on the gaming in oil, which has driven up the price of oil to over $4 a gallon. It also happened back in 2008 in the summer, where oil got up to $147 a barrel. After that, 60 Minutes did an expose where we learned that these Wall Street banks had held more oil than ExxonMobil would ever hold. And they have tankers driving around in circles, and they're just basically trading paper barrels back and forth and running the price up. Sounds like they've been doing that again. What is wrong with the CTFC? Why is the watchdog a complete lapdog for Wall Street?
Well, in defense of the CFTC and its chairman, Gary Gensler, I would say that it is not entirely their fault. First of all, they're vastly underfunded. They run on roughly $200 million a year. The Los Angeles Police Department, I'm sure, is several multiples of that. They are underfunded because Congress won't approve the funding, again, because Wall Street sponsored members of Congress have sought to starve them. And second, on the efforts to propose rules that would curb speculation, Wall Street has sued them. They have a rule out on position limits that would limit the amount of any particular commodity, financial product that any single firm could control. And the Chamber of Commerce took them to court under a technicality having to do with an inadequate cost-benefit analysis. And they took them to a court that has a history of siding with business, with Wall Street. So they have those two strikes against them. They're understaffed, and they've got litigation blocking some of their rules. That said, they could do a better job. We think that they've buckled to Wall Street on too many issues. This does require a what is being alleged by Michael Greenberger and other very enlightened and skillful, knowledgeable people is essentially market manipulation, and there needs to be a vigorous Justice Department investigation. And while we applaud the president, Eric Holder, for announcing one, and it's possible that simply that announcement has led to a dip, if you will, in gas prices, we're skeptical that they are vigorous. We think we should see some indictments soon.
Well, Bartlett Naylor, there have not been any indictments for what happened on Wall Street in 2008. And it felt to me that one of the reasons why the president had Eric Holder with him was to put him on camera with him, almost to put him on the spot. What's going on or what's not going on at Justice? I don't understand it. I mean, yeah. 60 Minutes did a whole piece with the guy, is it Lenny Hall, what's his name, the guy from the Clinton White House that's in charge of this division that's looking into Wall Street? And they asked them, how come you guys haven't come up with one prosecution? And they had a woman there who was an insider in the biggest ripoff operation out here in California that Bank of America bought.
Countrywide.
Countrywide. And she had all the inside scoop, and the Justice Department weren't interested in talking to her. So do you have any idea why this torpor?
I have no, if you will, inside information, inside insight. It's regrettable. One thing that is missing that was present during the savings and loan crisis is literally a mechanism, a training mechanism, whereby prudential bank examiners are told what kind of evidence does it take that can be handed over to the Justice Department to bring a criminal investigation. A prudential regulator, that's somebody from the FDIC or the Federal Reserve, is going in to look generally for signs that the firm might be failing, that its loans might be going bad, that its capital might be inadequate, but they're not necessarily looking for fraud. And they need to be trained to look for the things that a prosecutor at the Justice Department can take into a court, to a grand jury and get an indictment, and to a jury and a judge to win a prosecution. That was present in the late 1980s, and it's missing today.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who is the Financial Policy Advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the Principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the Chief of Investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christina Trutanich. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.